Welcome back to the lecture. What did we do last week? We just briefly talked about it during the exercise or during the tutorial already, that we looked at the security proof. For the construction of unidirectional registered key exchange that we introduced 1 week earlier than that, and for the definition that we introduced even 2 weeks before that. And that's somewhat the peak of complexity for the entire lecture series. It is somewhat, it should have given you an idea of how to prove such complicated, complex protocols with tools that we learned throughout the previous lectures. For a tool that could be used in real-world messaging protocols, but since we just considered a very small fraction of a real messaging protocol, in particular, we just looked at unidirectional communication, we just looked at continuous key exchange, so we didn't look at real message encryption, we didn't look at interaction between Alice and Bob, where also Bob contributes new information to Bob to Alice, and so on. So we removed a lot of complexity to just focus on a small building block, but still the proof was doable and hopefully also comprehensible within one lecture. For the remaining few lectures that we have until the end of the semester, we will look at other building blocks that are helpful, relevant, and interesting in the messaging context. But for none of them, we will introduce or look at formal security proofs, because the security proofs are typically more complicated. We can't fit them into a lecture, and they won't give you much more, I don't know, intuition for how to prove security for such things. Instead, what we do, for example, starting today, is, so we briefly did that in last week's lecture and exercise already. We look at weak randomness as a threat vector. And what we've seen last week is that under weak randomness, this construction of unidirectional ratcheted key exchange, for which we proved that it is secure as long as randomness is good, is, so we saw that as long as randomness is good, we even proved that it is secure, but as soon as randomness is bad, we see that this construction becomes insecure. And there are different ways how to handle that. Either we just assume or think that weak randomness is not a threat at all, but we will see there are a couple of reasons why weak randomness should be considered. And instead, what we then do in the second step today is we look at a building block that could help us, or that helps us actually provably, to enhance this unidirectional ratcheted key exchange construction such that it becomes secure even under weak randomness. So it is strongly secure according to that definition, even if we allow the adversary furthermore to reveal or even modify or determine the random coins that the sender is using. And this building block that we look at is called key updatable key encapsulation mechanism. We will look at two different construction ideas of how to build key encapsulation or key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms. And depending on the time, we will then look at the double ratchet. So in the exercise today, we briefly went into looking how far parts of the double ratchet fit into our formalization of unidirectional ratcheted key exchange, how far this offers security, and we had a high-level overview of what the double ratchet does when we also look at bidirectional interaction. But yeah, this will be something that we will do at the end of today's lecture. Okay, so first of all, what we observed is that unidirectional ratcheted key exchange under weak randomness is a problem. So why is that a problem? First of all, the motivation. Why is it a threat? So first of all, we talked about this last week already. There are situations in which the devices that we use didn't gather enough randomness, enough entropy to be a good seed for key generation, for example, or for anything else that we use randomness for. So the first problem could be that there is too little entropy. There could be multiple reasons for why there is too little entropy, because there are too few sensors that help to collect entropy, or the runtime of the device that we are using is too short so far to collect enough entropy, and many, many other reasons. Okay, the second threat vector that we consider, so this is just we don't get enough random information that an attacker doesn't see. The second is that the attacker is actually responsible for not having enough entropy, because maybe it influenced the way we collect entropy, or maybe the way we use the entropy and then turn it into bits that we can process with our cryptographic algorithms is influenced by the attacker. And a couple of examples are the so-called Debian bug. In which the randomness generator implemented on the Debian operating system had a flaw. And it is not quite clear whether this was intentional or just unintentional bug, but definitely the result was that the randomness used by cryptographic algorithms was bad, not sufficient, insufficient to have any security guarantees. I talked about the TLS extension that was proposed and that added information about the random bits that are collected to the publicly visible transcript. It's unclear how far this is exploitable, but definitely it is unclear also how far the security guarantees still hold. If there is information leaked about the randomness that is internally also used by cryptographic algorithms. And so there can be multiple attacks against random number generators. We've also seen that so devices can be attacked via multiple different side channels. They can be either attacked by influencing the computation with lasers, with all the, I don't know, I'm not a side channel person, but there are side channels that can either be influenced or that can be extracted by observing what happens on a chip. And for that reason, we have different models to capture this type of attacks. The first one is that the random coins that an algorithm uses are given to the attacker. So the attacker learns which randomness is used by the cryptographic algorithms, but typically the assumption is still that the randomness is generated uniformly with full entropy. And this captures only parts or some of the threat vectors that we think are relevant. A stronger adversarial model is that the attacker can manipulate the random coins. We will also see that in a setting in which we have group messaging, for example, so we have multiple users communicating together, and the guarantees are that we have security We have confidentiality of our messages towards everyone except the members inside the group. Then this means that all the users who have been removed from the group should not have any information about the messages that we exchange in the group right now. But there are protocols in which the secrets that we use to encrypt our messages are influenced by the entire history of the group chat. So there could have been a malicious member in the group that manipulated their way of generating randomness. And so even if there was ever a malicious member in the group and that malicious member maliciously changed the way they sampled their randomness for their computation, we want that even after this user was removed from the group, that the group internally is secure again, that even this malicious prior member of the group has no impact on future computation. And so this is also captured by an adversary that is able to manipulate the random coins of malicious previous users. For the particular context that we are in, we have three algorithms that we considered. The first one was initialization. And of course, if the initialization uses either revealed random coins or manipulated random coins, then there is no hope for security. Because of course, if the randomness is known to the attacker, then the state of the receiver is known. And this immediately means that if the initial receiver state is known to the attacker, then also all the future computations that receiver would do are known to the attacker. And since the receiver will be able to compute everything, if this is the initial state, then also everything that the sender will ever produce, will ever output, is known to the attacker. And so we have no... security in terms of confidentiality at all. For the receive algorithm, so if the receive algorithm either uses randomness that was revealed or manipulated, this doesn't have an effect, at least as long as we look at this notion of unidirectional ratcheted key exchange, because the receive algorithm is deterministic. So no randomness is used, but the send algorithm is interesting. So the send algorithm looks as follows. So we have send algorithm that takes a state and that probabilistically outputs a new state and a key and a ciphertext. So if we de-randomize this algorithm, then we have input state and randomness. This is the way that we write it. Still, output, key, state, and ciphertext are the ones that that are output, and this is either influenced or known to the attacker. So, what is the outcome of that? First of all, if the input sender state is known, then we have two outcomes. What are the two outcomes? So what happens if the sender state is known? We talked about this in the exercise last week. So if the sender state is known and the randomness of the send algorithm is influenced or known by the attacker, what's the outcome? This is correct, and of course also the key is known. Exactly. But at least from the perspective of trivial attacks, nothing else is immediately known. So no other key is immediately affected. If there is just one send algorithm for which the randomness was bad, or if there are just 2 or 10 send algorithms with bad randomness, then these particular keys are affected if the state is known, but no other keys are affected by that. The problem was with our particular URKE construction. What was the problem there? Does anybody remember what the problem was with our URKE construction? I can just tell you that it was So in principle, the construction looked as follows. It computed a key and a ciphertext via the encapsulation to the current encapsulation key. Now let's de-randomize this encapsulation. And then the final key, as well as some transcript and the next decapsulation key, were output by the random oracle on input of the key, the transcript, and the ciphertext, and so on. And then the idea of generating the next encapsulation key was to use the decapsulation key that was output by the random oracle. So the big problem here was that the decapsulation key is computed on the sender side, and the key, or all the secret inputs, which is just this symmetric key here, this symmetric key is known if the attacker knows encapsulation key and the randomness. And so the problem here is that once the decapsulation key is known, all future decapsulation keys will also be known. At least in the construction that we've seen, everything from that moment on until the end of the execution is known, because the attacker now knows basically everything that the sender, that the receiver knows. It knows the core secret that is responsible for protecting confidentiality in our construction. And what we on a high level tried to implement here was an algorithm that takes as input an encapsulation key and some associated data and produces a fresh encapsulation key in a way such that the decapsulation key is never known. So simultaneously, we would like to have an update algorithm that takes as input the decapsulation key and some associated data and produces the decapsulation key. But the idea here is that on the sender side, on the encapsulation side, this decapsulation key that is produced on the receiver side is never leaked to the one who is executing that algorithm. So this was what we wanted to have, but that we didn't have. And now, what we would like to have now is something that we call key updatable key encapsulation mechanism, short QCEM. And the basic idea is as follows. We have Alice and Bob. And Bob produces a key pair. Secret key, public key. And shares the public key with Alice. Now both Alice and Bob can update their part of the key pair using the update algorithm with some associated data. And then at some point, Alice can use her key to encapsulate something to Bob. And so she sends that ciphertext to Bob, who can use his decapsulation algorithm to compute the same key. And after that, Alice can continue to update her public key using the update algorithm. And also Bob can update his secret key using his update algorithm. So this is the primitive that we would like to have, and this can continue forever. The formal syntax that we would like to have is that we have a gen algorithm, an enc algorithm, and a dec algorithm, and all of them are just exactly the same as for a normal key encapsulation mechanism. So the gen algorithm produces from no input with random coins a secret key and a public key. The enc algorithm takes the public key as input and produces a symmetric key and a ciphertext, and the decapsulation algorithm takes a secret key and a ciphertext and outputs a symmetric key. The interesting part is now the update algorithm, and there are two update algorithms, one for the secret key holder and one for the public key holder. And so the public key, together with some associated data, updates to a new public key. Just as the secret key, together with some associated data, produces a new secret key. This is the high-level idea. So we just have a normal CEM And we just have two further algorithms that take the respective component of the key pair and update the component of the key pair. Correctness. Anybody has an idea, an intuition for how one could specify correctness here? I think so it definitely starts with the intuition from the chem that the decapsulation of with a secret key of a ciphertext should output a key. In the sense that the initial secret key pair, or the initial key pair, is generated together. And then for any associated data, sampled from the set of associated data strings, we want that the secret key I is computed by taking the update of the secret key of I minus 1 and the associated data I. We do the same with the public key, so the public key I is computed by using the update algorithm applied on the previous public key and the current associated data. And then the key for which, or the key in ciphertext for which we want to have security, correctness, is processed or computed by using the encapsulation algorithm with the newest public key. So this is essentially just the same as for a normal chem, and we should always, both for syntax, correctness, and security, if we want to extend a primitive, we just should extend it based on the core definition. And the correctness of a chem is still that the key decapsulated from a ciphertext that was produced by the encapsulation under a public key should be the same as the encapsulation key. So the key that is produced on both sides here should be the same if the ciphertext is the same. And the key pair is somewhat in a relation that we expect. And the relation that we expect for a normal chem is that the key pair is generated together. And the extension that we have here is that the key pair is jointly updated with the same associated data string. Once the associated data string differs, we do not expect any correctness guarantees anymore. So as soon as there is one step of updates less on the receiver side than on the sender side, or if there is one bit flipped or changed for any of the updates, we do not expect any correctness anymore. Does that make sense? Our security definition is a little bit too complicated to write it down entirely, but on a very high level, what we always need to do in order to understand what security means is we have to write down the oracles. And the oracles specify or capture what the adversarial capabilities are. So the oracles that we consider in this setting are an encapsulation oracle, and that encapsulation oracle outputs ciphertext and a challenge key, just as for a normal CAM. Then we have an update public key oracle that takes as input an associated data string and outputs a new public key. We also have an update secret key oracle that takes an associated data string and outputs nothing, because of course the secret key is the information that we use to obtain any secrecy for the keys encapsulated. Then we have a decapsulation oracle that takes ciphertexts and either outputs the key or it outputs nothing. And this latter case in the case that the ciphertext C that is input to the decapsulation here is a challenge. And now finally, and this is the relevant part, for this let's look at our idea of the execution again and our motivation. So we come from a world in which we want to have an update routine for the encapsulation key on the sender side and the decapsulation key on the receiver side. And the first property that we want to have is that for the update of the encapsulation key, we want that the decapsulation key is not leaked. And in principle, we want that even if the attacker knows all the inputs, including the encapsulation key and the randomness and the associated data, then this here should leak no secret information. But there is a second property that I didn't speak about, but that is captured by this idea here, this idea of the update that we implement in our unidirectional ratcheted key exchange construction, and that is the reason for why we ever wanted to update our encapsulation key to a new encapsulation key. And so maybe you have an idea of what the final oracle is that we would like to have in order to specify security for the key updatable key encapsulation mechanism. So if our game so far consists of a challenge oracle or an encapsulation oracle that outputs ciphertext and keys, we have oracles to control how the updates are performed. We have a decapsulation oracle to consider that we have active adversaries. What is the final oracle that makes sense here to be considered? So where do we come from? What is the setting that we use the update for? What is the reason why we update our encapsulation key here to obtain a new encapsulation key? What is the reason why we update the decapsulation key on the receiver side to a new decapsulation key? Or put differently, what is the threat for which which motivates why we update key material. Maybe what is the main threat that we considered in the entire series of lectures so far? Besides active adversaries listening on the network and being active on the network. Okay, so everybody wake up now. We use this primitive key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms to build our ratcheted key exchange. And we just consider the unidirectional version of that now. And we use it because our construction that we discussed last week, for which we proved security last week, has an update mechanism for encapsulation keys and for decapsulation keys. And that update mechanism consists of encapsulating a key in a ciphertext, and then on both sides using that key as input to the random oracle to compute either the new encapsulation key or on the receiver side to compute the new decapsulation key. So what is the reason why we update our encapsulation key and decapsulation key? Without, you don't have to tell me an oracle that we have to add now for key, for KuCams. You just should explain to me now why we do update our key material. What is the reason? And there is not a single reason, but maybe you can tell me one reason. Okay, two hands. I want 3/4. Forward security. Very good. So for forward security, there is a second reason. What's the second reason? So, yeah? Post-compromise security is another one, but that's not achieved by these types of updates. Implicitly. Not really. Yeah. We will see only as a side effect. But there is a second, maybe then a third reason what we did or why we wanted to have these types of updates. So we had forward security and we had a second. For some kind of confirmation, not really confirmation, but the direction is not wrong.
Check if sender and receiver are still in sync.
Yeah, more or less. So implicitly. So what we did in our construction was we used signatures to authenticate the traffic from Alice to Bob. But we also used the random oracle here with the transcript and the ciphertext to make sure that even if our signatures fail, because there is a trivial impersonation. The sender is exposed. The sender state is used to produce a valid-looking ciphertext to the receiver. So Alice and Bob are out of sync. And then we use the random oracle to make sure that the output key material is independent. So that's not really a confirmation, but the idea is that key material is implicitly authenticated, or the outputs are implicitly authenticated in the sense that even in the worst case, even if there is a trivial impersonation, the attacker cannot make sure that Alice and Bob can ever communicate again. So everything is out of sync after that. Exactly. So we keep those two properties in mind. Now, final question, which type of oracle should we add here in order to capture those properties? And you don't have to give me the exact name, it's just about what type of output should that oracle have. Maybe you remember forward secure chems. For forward secure chems, the difference in the syntax was that the decapsulation algorithm outputs a new secret key. So there was only an update on the receiver side. Here we have updates on the sender and the receiver side. But there was also, of course, a difference in the security game. So what was the difference in the security game? What did we allow the adversary in addition or additionally to do? And for that reason, we add a corruption oracle that tells the attacker the current version of the secret key. The goal of the attacker is to learn the challenge bit. Obvious. And now finally, we have to specify trivial attacks in order to understand at least intuitively what type of security guarantees we want to have. So, what are the trivial attacks? And in order to understand what we really want, we rather stay on the non-trivial attack side. So what type of security guarantees should our primitive give us here? And we talked about this briefly a second ago. So there are two security guarantees that we want to have from this primitive. We had forward security and we had this. It's not confirmation, but rather implicit authenticity. So what does that mean? What, any ideas of what we would like to have here? So you see these oracles here. What type of attacks should be hard to achieve? Under which conditions should it be hard for an attacker to learn the challenge bit intuitively, if we would like to use this primitive in our URKE construction. Okay, yeah, that's the stronger guarantee. I will write that down in a second. What's the other guarantee that we would like to have? The first guarantee is that previous session keys or previous keys, okay, should stay secure. Even if later secret keys are corrupted. After updates. And this should even hold with associated data that is controlled by the adversary. The second property that we want to have, and that was already mentioned, is that if Alice and Bob communicate, but there is an update with associated data on Alice's side that outputs a public key, and there is an update of Bob with different associated data on Bob's side that outputs a secret key, such that associated data AD and associated data prime is different, and then the output public key is used for producing a ciphertext for encapsulating a key, and the secret key here on that side is ever corrupted. Let's write both of those things here in red. Then still, the ciphertext should produce a key that is not distinguishable from a random key. So the second property that we want to have is that keys K should stay secure. Even if incompatible secret keys are corrupted. And secret keys are incompatible if they were updated with different associated data. Then used for the public key. Okay, so these are the high-level intuitive security guarantees, and if you want to learn how this is captured in games, in the way we specified other things before, you can look at the papers that propose the following ideas of constructions. And the core here now should be focused on understanding how these constructions look like. So, construction, intuitive. And for this, we remind ourselves that there was a primitive that is called hierarchical identity-based encryption that has the following concept. On the encryption side, we have a public key and an identity string as input, and the output is then just as normal for a chem, the key and a ciphertext. And the idea is we have a hierarchy of identities, and the encryption or the encapsulator can take the public key of the root of this hierarchy and encapsulate to any identity in the entire tree of identities. So in this hierarchy, the sender can choose one of the identities and say, I want to send something to this identity. And for this identity on the receiver side to get the corresponding secret key, we have a delegation algorithm that takes some secret key with ID string ID and a second ID string ID prime. And the output is then the secret key of ID concatenated with ID prime. So this was the general idea. And now the construction. Any idea of how to build key updatable chem from HIBE? Any idea? So maybe as a quick reminder for forward secure chem, we used this HIBE thing as follows. So we have an initial secret key, and whenever we want to encrypt something to the receiver, we have a nonce. And this nonce tells us which path to choose in order to get the actual secret key with which something is encrypted. And now, in order to decrypt this thing, we first delegate in the hierarchies of secret keys. Then we remove everything that was on that path. And we delegate all the secret keys on the copath and remember these secret keys. And so once there is a second ciphertext that we would like to see, we again, so for example, let's say that this is the second path of a ciphertext of a nonce that we would like to decrypt. Then first, again, we remove all information that was on that path, and the only thing that we remember are the secret keys on the copath. So this was the idea of forward secure chem. But here, the setting is slightly different. So still we want forward security, but we also want this property that once the update on the sender side is different from the update on the receiver side, we want that the receiver secret key does not leak any information about keys encapsulated on the sender side. Yeah?
We put just one branch where we always delegate paradigms when new SLCs with data. And yeah, if ever the SLCs with data to pass, then we get all branches and we never meet again.
So. Okay, so let's. So, what would you like to describe first? How the update of the encapsulation key or of the public key works, or how the update of the secret key works?
Secret key.
Secret key. Okay, so we have an initial secret key zero. That's the root, yeah?
And then, if you have associated data.
So we do some updates. Let's say we do an update of secret key zero and some associated data. What do we do then?
We just
Exactly. So let's say this is then the second secret key. There are many, many other secret keys to which we could have delegated or updated. And this is our update. Okay. And then from the secret key, what do we then next if we delegate again? Or update again, we exactly just delegate again. That was a stupid question. Secret key 2, and this continues forever until secret key n. Okay, so this is the way the secret key is updated. How is the public key updated?
As to set all the additional data.
Sorry? So the public key consists of the initial key, public key, and an empty string. And the public key 1 consists of the initial public key and the first associated data.
Associated public key.
Yeah. So this is something people call it authenticated data, people call it additional data, people call it associated data. The original definition of authenticated encryption with associated data, the paper that was specified or that specified this primitive is by Phil Rogoway, and Phil Rogoway called it associated data. Because it can be something that is never sent over the wire, it can be some context information, so it's not necessarily something additional, it's not necessarily authenticated, it's just associated to the context. That's the reason why I always call it associated, but at every cryptographic conference, if you call it additional data, people still know what you're talking about. But I call it associated data. Okay. And so on. And so the actual encapsulation, or let's just write down the idea. Update of public key and associated data is keep a list of update strings update secret key with associated data extend path in HIBE identity hierarchy. Okay, some quick observations. So the first observation is the public key grows. But there are HIBE constructions for which compression of the public key is possible. So and so the idea is basically inside of the encapsulation algorithm, some HIBE schemes take the original public key, use the identity string here, and build a public key that is useful just for this identity string. And if you can do that, and if you can do the specification of public keys for a specific identity string continuously for always growing identities, then you always only need to have or need to remember this specified public key. And if this public key is even of constant size, then your public key never grows in the construction that we look at here. A much bigger problem is that the depth of the HIBE is linear in the number of updates. And that means, so if you don't know how often you will update your public key or secret key, you need to use an unbounded depth HIBE. And such unbounded depth HIBEs are typically inefficient, are based on building blocks like lattices or pairings, and those building blocks are non-standard. And if you would like to build a messaging protocol, then typically you would just like to use very, very standard, very simple, very efficient components. And unbounded depth HIBEs are so far not based, also we don't know any type of construction that gives us an unbounded depth HIBE based on efficient building blocks. Interestingly, we can prove that unidirectional ratcheted key exchange under weak randomness so secure against weak randomness is equivalent to key updatable KEM. So if we specify security in the natural way that we did it during the entire lecture so far, with very few exceptions, in which we specify the trivial attacks just based on correctness, the adversarial capabilities, and the adversarial goal, and we allow the attacker to weaken the randomness of the send algorithm, then we can prove that QCAM is equivalent to unidirectional ratcheted key exchange. And the idea is basically, so this proof goes by construction. The proof is basically we built unidirectional ratcheted key exchange from QCAM, and then we built QCAM from unidirectional ratcheted key exchange. And if we can build both of these things from each other, then we know these things are equivalent, at least from the complexity perspective. Both of them are equally complex. If you can build one of the other, it is clear that you need the other one to build the other one, basically, or something that is equivalently strong. And this is a paper by Bali et al. From AsiaCrypt 2020. Determining the core primitive of ratcheted key exchange. But, so, I told you now, building key updatable KEMs is difficult because key updatable KEMs need unbounded depth HIBE. Unbounded depth HIBE is expensive, so we don't want to build that. The long story here is that the first strong construction of unidirectional ratcheted key exchange was one of my papers that I wrote during my PhD. Then this proof here, so I am one of the et al. Here, so proving that this thing is important to build URKE was the next step at the late stages during my PhD, and then this question of how far is this thing relevant kept in my mind for a long time until 2 years ago I came up with an idea of how to build this thing differently, more efficiently. So there are new constructions. Of QCAM. And the idea is that now, if we have a bounded number of updates, then we can build this thing from IBE. So what is IBE? IBE is HIBE with just one layer of updates, delegation. So you just have an initial secret key and then you delegate this secret key to a second layer with just one identity string. You can't do this multiple times. And we know that IBE can be built or based off the DDH assumption. So we can, instead of using pairings or lattices, we can build IBE from Diffie-Hellman. And so if we know in advance how many updates we want to do, then we can just build a construction that uses the DDH assumption. And interestingly, if we have an unbounded number of updates, then we can use a bounded depth HIBE. So this construction here was pretty simple. I don't say that your idea wasn't clever, but I think it's still pretty clear that if you use a secret key, you want to obtain another secret key via an update with associated data, and we want to have the guarantees that we would like to have, which are, if you corrupt the late secret key, you don't know what was encapsulated to an early public key, and also if you delegate to a or update to a secret key that is here in the tree, and the public key was updated with different strings of of associated data, then this corrupted secret key will not tell you anything about keys encapsulated with the public key updated differently. This was the idea. The problem was that for each update, we need to go one level deeper in the identity tree. That was the reason why I said that the depth of the HIBE is linear in the number of updates, which means that we need an unbounded depth HIBE, and this is expensive. But I now tell you that there are new constructions from last year, and these new constructions work roughly as follows. So this is from last year's Eurocrypt. Unique path identity-based encryption. And the idea is as follows. So we have a secret key that is again the root secret key. And then we have a very wide hierarchy in the tree. And this is basically the number of epochs. So we have some epochs. So this is epoch 1, this is epoch 2, this is epoch 3, and so on until epoch 8. But we can configure the number of epochs. So the depth here, or this is, let's call this, this is the depth of these epochs, and so in total we have 2 to the L epochs. And then under these epochs we have updates. And then we have more updates in the next epoch. And the basic principle is that these updates are, these updates here are basically performed here. But once I get into this level here, which is level T, so this here has depth T. So if I am in depth L plus T down here, I cut my updates and start from here again and do my updates there. Once I reach the level L plus T again, I go one step further to the next epoch. And perform updates here. Once I am there at the bottom, I continue here, and so forth. And so the high-level idea is that I start with this secret key here. I go down to the bottom here, go to the next epoch, go down to the bottom here, go to the next epoch, go to the bottom here with my updates. Go to the next epoch, and so on. What I do is, I will start here, delegate to this node, will, just as in all the previous constructions that we've seen, especially in the forward secure chem setting, I will remove this secret key, remember the copath, so remember this secret key. I will go to this node, will remember this secret key, go to this node, remember this secret key, go to this node, and then I do what we did in the construction over here. I will just forget everything that I knew before, go to the next level, will forget everything here, go to the next level, and so on. So when I'm here, I just know this secret key, this secret key, this secret key, and this secret key. I go down to this level, just remember this secret key here. Then I will start from here, go down this level, will remember this secret key. Once I am here, I know this bottom secret key, I know this bottom secret key, I know this intermediate secret key here, I know this secret key, and this secret key. This is roughly the idea. And now, if I encrypt, and this is very high level, very intuitive, you don't need to remember things, but if you want to understand things, the high level intuition is, if I want to encapsulate to this identity here, so the entire string of updates, the entire string of associated data strings, is the concatenation of the associated data strings used for the updates in this lower part here. And so if I want to encapsulate to this associated data string here, or to this long associated data string that ends here, then I will encapsulate to this leaf, to this leaf, and to this intermediate associated data string. And the guarantee that I have is that a user who updated until here with the same string of associated data strings knows this secret key, knows this secret key, and knows this secret key. But if there is one bit flipped in one of the associated data strings, then either I am off the path here, or I'm off the path here, or I'm off the path here. So I don't, so maybe I know this secret key and I know this secret key, but then I don't know this secret key here. So basically, I spread the strings into different subpaths, and if there is just one path, or if there is just one bit in the entire path in which there is a difference, then this difference will be reflected in one of my subpaths, and therefore the secret key at which the branch happened, and let's say this branch happened in this substring here, is not known to the attacker. So if the public key and the secret key branched at some point, and the secret key is corrupted, and the secret key branch happened in this substring, then corrupting this secret key here will not tell me what was in another subpath of this part, this subpart of the tree here. This is a very, very high level idea. As I said, you don't need to remember this for the exam, but it's just maybe an idea for you how to build such cryptographic building blocks and how to make things a little bit more efficient. Okay. So the overall idea is that, as I said, this construction needs bounded depth HIBE, where the depth is L plus T. And of course, if we set L to 0, then the depth is just T, and the depth is then just one path. And so this construction here is one extreme where there is just a single epoch, and everything in that epoch is one path that is very long. But if I know that there will be a very long string of associated data, and I want to split that string into many, many epochs, and I want to bound the depth of this tree here, then I split these substrings here into many, many strings, and so I have a larger L, because the larger L gets, the more epochs I have exponentially, and so I spread the long associated data strings into many, many epochs, and therefore I basically bound the depth of the tree into something that can be linear in the so-called security parameter. And this gives us a construction that can only rely on bounded depth HIBE. A learning of all of that is that's basically the last time we talk about optimal security. Optimal security definitions often lead to impractical constructions. So although we come up with a construction for key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms from bounded depth HIBE, bounded depth HIBE is still not super practical. Nevertheless, the longer we do research, the better we become with finding good constructions, and maybe at some point someone will develop a bounded depth HIBE that is super efficient. The interesting part is optimal security definitions maybe don't teach us about efficiency of constructions, but they teach us about the underlying components, the underlying principles that we need. So they still teach us about fundamental principles and design ideas. On the other hand, it is pretty hard and so far unclear how to come up with systematic suboptimal security definitions. On the one hand, that is a pretty open question. On the other hand, I have a couple of open projects that I didn't fully start with, but that tries to tackle that research question. So we've seen there is a systematic method, there is a systematic process of how to define security as strong as possible. And this is somewhat the outcome. We come up with constructions that teach us things, but that won't be deployed in practice. But it's still useful to have a process for how to come up with a definition of security. And it would be interesting and useful to come up with something that tells us how to do that for suboptimal security guarantees. So there are some projects, many projects, maybe even, for working on that research question, for how to define security systematically, even if things are not super strong. And I would say that this is basically the end of ideal messaging . Next week and the remaining weeks, we will talk about real-world messaging. So we started with the double ratchet already, but since we just have 5 minutes left, I won't talk about the double ratchet too much today, but the double ratchet will be the next thing that we talk about, and after that we talk about group messaging. So how do we build group messaging? One of the things that I talked about very briefly is the message layer security standard that is now standardized, that will be implemented in a couple of real-world messengers. And the idea is to reduce the overhead of communication from using pairwise channels. So if we have N users, we don't want to send a message to all of these N users individually. Instead of, we want to have something that has sublinear communication overhead. Maybe just to briefly start, the double ratchet algorithm is the next thing to look at. And maybe just before I go deeper into the double ratchet thing, I will start from scratch or from the beginning of that next week. Just a very quick overview of what we did today. So we realized weak randomness is a problem. Weak randomness is a problem in the construction that we looked at so far. If we want to have strong security, even against weak randomness, we need a different building block. The building block that we found is key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms. The property that we want to have from this primitive is that, on the one hand, it should offer forward security. So if there is an update of the secret key, then everything encapsulated to previous secret keys should stay secure. And if the updates of sender and receiver, of public key and secret key, differ, then the secret key being corrupted should not tell the attacker anything about keys encapsulated with the differently updated public key. The first very simple construction idea was based immediately on hierarchical identity-based encryption. A reminder, there was this forward secure cam. The forward secure cam only achieves forward security. So it makes sure that if I update, then the new secret key will not be able to decrypt previous keys. But this forward secure cam does not have this diverging property. So once sender and receiver updated their keys differently, then the forward secure cam does not capture this, because the public key in the forward secure cam is never updated. But if we want to build that, then we use HIBE immediately. The idea is each update on the secret key side delegates the secret key in the HIBE tree one level lower directly with the delegation algorithm. And the public key update is performed by just attaching associated data strings to the previous public key. The problem of this construction is that public keys grow. This is not the biggest problem. The bigger problem is that this is built based on unbounded depth HIBE. There is a newer construction of this that uses only bounded depth HIBE, and the rough idea is to split the concatenation of associated data strings into substrings and placing these substrings into a larger level binary tree of epochs. So we start on the very left with our first substring of associated data string updates. Then we continue in the next epoch, continue in the next epoch, and so on. And the idea is that once a branch in the two associated data strings happens between the receiver side and the sender side, then this branch needs to happen in one of these substrings. And so what we do is we encapsulate to the secret key of all of the leaves substrings, or of all of the leaves in these substrings. And the result of the branch in one of these substrings is that one of these secret keys, or the secret key in the branch, is not helpful to obtain information on the branched other substring that happened on the sender side. This is the rough high-level idea. The learning is we learn a lot by looking at the ideal world, and in the next weeks we will learn more about the real world. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Then I see you next week.